welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Kimberly Gautreau.
And Kim's here filling in for Deb, and it's her first time on the air today. So congratulations, Kim, and good
Thank
luck
you.
On the show here. So today's show is a show, and it's titled Rape Culture. And along with the title comes the fact that if you're listening out there and you have triggers around sexual assault and sexual violence, I strongly recommend that you take it easy on this show. There's going to be some content in the show that may trigger you, and I don't want any of our listeners to have any problems with the show. So we do have the blogs up on www.betweenthemargins.ca after the show, and if these types of topics are problematic to you, you might want to listen to the show after when you can do so at your own pace and your own time frame. And, you know, I hate to send listeners away, but I also don't want anybody to get hurt by any of the stuff that I put on the air. So take care of yourselves out of there. And it's a very important topic. And we've got Margaret Lazarus on the phone. Are you there, Margaret?
Hi, yes, I am.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
You are 30-plus years expert on this topic, so can you introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I've been making documentary films for a long time, and I'm also someone who's been consistently active in issues of violence against women and children. And in 1970... Oh, my goodness. I made a film with my partner, Renner Winderlich, about rape. And we came up with the title, Rape Culture. And it was about the messages of the media about rape. And at that time, and that's not true now, we thought the most important thing we could do would be to address the myths that people had about rape. Although now I take that back. But at that time, we thought the most important thing was to say the things that women in the who were active in working against violence and women who were active in women's issues were saying about how people believed women wanted it, that it had something to do with the way they dressed, that they brought it on. And many other myths. I remember one fellow in the documentary saying, well, you can't thread a moving needle, implication being you can't rape someone if they don't want it. So we made a whole film about rape myths. We included lots of pieces from different films that we saw, not documentaries, but dramatic films, including the classic one from Gone with the Wind, where Scarlett O'Hara says no, 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 and then she proceeds to enjoy it, which is one of the major rape myths we address. Women say no when they mean yes, and many other films of the time. We thought we were part of this great movement to end the mythology, and to some degree, we were successful in getting the lies out there about what people believed about rape and challenging the media. But as the current events point out, there's always backsliding, and there's been a serious backsliding, and some of these myths continue. I just want to say quickly before somebody else picks up the conversation, I guess almost 20 years later, in 2003, many of our people who use our material said, we need a new film about rape, so we made another film about rape. We called it Rape Is. And at that point, one of the big issues we decided to address was how people wanted to narrowly define rape, mostly call it something that happens when a stranger pops out of the bushes, and we wanted to show and expand the definition of rape to include so much of what we call well, so much of what goes on in the socializing world when people go to bars, and also what happens to young children, instead of calling, we call it child rape, and what happens in prisons. So, that's kind of a long-winded summary, but that's where I am.
Wonderful. And an Academy Award winner to boot, yes.
Oh, yes. Thank you. As I said, we make films about violence, and one of our films about domestic violence, Defending Our Lives, received an Academy Award. And I'm also one of the many authors of the chapter on violence against women in Our Bodies Ourselves.
Wonderful. I've just got a short clip for our audience just to kind of frame what rape culture is, and play that for you now.
For me, rape culture is a product of an overarching culture of violence and dominance.
Rape culture is a culture in which the violence against women is looked upon in a not just positive manner, but something that's common. It's expected.
And it's acceptable.
Rape culture is a culture in which rape is everyday, commonplace, and allowed through basic attitudes and beliefs about gender, sexuality, and violence. Rape has been normalized. Rape culture consists of music, television, advertisements, images, movies, myths, and beliefs.
We go through this culture in our society, like, thinking that, like, these things that we're not necessarily comfortable with are normal, and that there might even be, like, something wrong with us for, like, feeling this way.
Rape culture mostly consists of verbal abuse, discrimination even, oppression, and that's harder for people to understand. It makes it more a community responsibility instead of a family problem, you know? And you know, you just put the bad people away and rape will go away. That's not going to happen because it's so much more than that, and that's why it's harder to talk about it, because then it's harder to get rid of.
So that gives you a background of what rape culture is. And you know, one thing that I want to add to that is that it's this culture about rape and how we deal and cope with rape. And, I mean, one person is quoted as saying, you know, when you see articles about drunk driving, the police are quoted telling people to stop drinking and driving. But when you read articles about sexual assault, there's no warning telling would-be attackers not to rape. Instead, the authorities tell potential victims to take precautions. That pretty much sum it up there, Margaret?
I think so. That was really an excellent compilation of quotes. And yes, and unfortunately, we're struggling against what is increasingly defined as a norm and is a form of entertainment and something that people can make money from. And it's a hard struggle.
Yes, it is. And it's ongoing. And as we'll hear later in the show, when we're talking to one of our other guests, she talks about the four myths of rape. And they're still in place. And
yes.
They're still the same. And it's been forever.
Well, yeah, well, you know, there's a reason for that. And that is that it's, if you analyze things in terms of power and control, which is something that we have to do, it's a privilege. It's part of the privileges and to push back against that, to say to people who want to be abusive, no, you can't get away with it. No, you have to respect the rights of other people. It's a power struggle. And unfortunately, it's a hard one.
Yeah.
And one that...
Go ahead.
And it's a struggle that doesn't garner a lot of sympathy in the mainstream media. And increasingly, we're you know, there's waves of efforts to discredit the struggle, and they call it, you know, oh, you're anti-sex, or, you know, you're a prude, or and my goodness, I mean, that's so opposite of what we're talking about. We're talking about joyously choosing sexuality, a man's sexuality that you want as an individual, not one that's perpetrated on you, not one that's forced on you. And I mean that quiets people down, or you're no fun, or you know, this is old fashioned, and you know, all that mythology is marshaled towards quieting those of us who want to say, wait a minute, let's look at this as a human rights struggle. Let's look at this as a struggle of people's rights being abused, and that somehow doesn't have traction in the print, in the movies, in the press. I mean, occasionally, of course, there's something excellent and wonderful, but it is overwhelmed by the vast majority of what else is out there.
Yeah, and in standard media, I mean, you don't have the opportunities to talk so much about human rights. I mean, I'm always grateful for the space that CHRW makes for me to put this show on the air, but it's not a show that is typically, well, one of the biggest things that I hear when we get emails from listeners is that nobody's ever heard anything like this on the air. And for me, that's a sad state of media.
Yeah, and you're in Canada, which we always have a fantasy. You do better than we do in the United States, so that's even more disconcerting to hear.
Well, we in Canada, we have a saying here that, you know, the U.S. will eventually catch up to us.
Hopefully.
Well, we can hope, you know. We give you all the resources we can to bring you up.
Well, good, because in terms of human rights and in terms of popular culture, and then we're the engine for the world, and that's another really sad thing. When you think about the messages, the myths and messages that go out to the world from our entertainment industry, and from our news industry, it makes this issue even more critical. I'm not saying there isn't horrendous human rights violations, particularly of women and children throughout the world, but if the cultures that are supposedly perpetrating human rights are pushing it, then there really is very hard to see how progress can be made.
It is, and especially when you were talking about rape culture, and mm-hmm. and we're talking about that embedded culture in our society where the language is harmful. I mean, there was a quote in the Toronto Star up here not too long ago on this very topic where the author quoted a professor, Lisa Gotell, who is an expert on sexual assault law at the University of Alberta. And she was taken aback to hear her own 15-year-old son describe his football team's crushing defeat as being, quote, totally raped, unquote.
Yes. I mean, and there's a, that's, but, you know, there's a way that language gets co-opted, as we used to say, but still, I mean, I like using the word rape, because to describe, if you describe things as assault, you won't really get to the nitty-gritty of the sexual violation that is happening, and language is extremely important. So the abuse of it, the abuse of it and calling something that is not rape rape is something we also, I mean, it's important to struggle against, to make the point of what it is, the violation that it really is. I mean, the other side of it, too, is that the people who are survivors of rape also internalize this horrendous message. And I remember one of the most poignant things, I worked as a peer rape counselor, that I ever experienced was this woman who said to me, well, maybe it was my fault. I was wearing these, you know, very bright orange socks. And I thought, oh, my goodness. I mean, here it is that not only are women blamed for being assaulted and raped, but unfortunately, this message is so pervasive that they internalize it themselves and think, well, maybe if I weren't at this place at this time, or maybe if I weren't, you know, if I weren't dressed nicely, or maybe if I hadn't, you know, gotten all fixed up to go out. And I, and that, again, that's part of the power struggle, though. All you have to do is convince the victims, the survivors, that it's their fault, and it destroys or weakens the struggle against it. I mean, people, as in every people's struggle, when the survivors think that it's their fault, they don't have the force. They don't have the force to struggle.
And I can fully, I'm a two-time survivor of sexual assault, and this show is difficult for me. It's not a show that I've been looking forward to personally, and it's been a challenge prepping for it, and it's been a challenge, you know, going through the material, and I've been triggered so many times putting this show together, but it's something that I believe in needs to be on the air, and women need to tell their stories no matter how much it hurts us. And let me tell you, audience, it hurts us. To personalize the message, I mean, this has been hard for me. And you know, the self-blame stuff is all there. I mean, my girlfriend at the time of the last incident thought that I was making the whole story up so that I could say that I had sex in Cuba, and so that she wouldn't be mad at me for cheating on her.
Mm-hmm. Well, I applaud you for coming forward with your story, and I think one piece of this is it's an important part of everyone's healing process who survives trauma. And the other piece of it is if enough of us come out there and tell our stories, we will empower each other for sure, and perhaps the world will get the message of how universal it is. I mean, just recently, for example, I was very glad that the reporter who was raped in Tahrir Square talked about it. I mean, despite the fact that not done by women reporters who part of the message they give is that I'm tough, I can do anything a man can do, but the story came out and it became very clear that rape happens everywhere. It happens where people think they can get away with it. Men, I guess. But there are exceptions to that. But when people think they can get away with it, they do it, and they exercise their power, and they take. I'm starting to think about a song we used in rape culture, which is "I Take Whatever I Want," and it was a popular song, and that's the message. And until all of us start saying, "No, you can't take it," somebody did that to me, and that was terrible, and it was a crime, and not only that, it was a crime, it was terrible, it was hurtful, and it's not your right to take it. Until we push really hard against that message and more of us come forward and say that it's happened to us, it's going to keep going.
That's for sure. I've got, there's a PSA, public service message, out of the UK that directly talks about this, and I've reorganized it a little bit for radio because it is a visual, and then I've got another PSA that was produced on the meaning of rape, and I put these two together, and it's just a short little clip, but it talks about a lot of this stuff.
Can I help?
Yeah, thanks. I'm going out tonight and I want to get raped. I need a scrap bottle and courage a guy to have sex with me against my will.
The blue one. Definitely the blue.
Check out this skirt. She's asking for it.
As if.
Nobody asks to be raped. Ever.
A lot of people think rape only happens in a dark alleyway. That beautiful women are the usual victims. But sexual violence isn't really about sex. It's about power.
And it can happen to anyone, anywhere.
And it's not your fault.
Yeah. I mean, I think something that was very helpful, which was part of what we did in the movie Rape is we interviewed a really perceptive guy who was in prison, and he talked about rape in prison. And what was so interesting about it was he described it in terms of the guys that were weaker and looked like they could be overpowered, were raped. And then one of the things that you did was you found the biggest, meanest con you could find, and he was your protector, and then other guys would leave you alone. I mean, and he kept describing how people, just the power dynamics of rape within the prison, and my mouth hung open when I first interviewed him because it was exactly the same power dynamic. And if you took it out of the gender equation, people came up to me after screening the film and said, I really got it. I really understand it. But it's sad and unfortunate that we had to make it, put it in the context where we eliminated the gender perspective on it for people to see, because the mythology about gender relations is so powerful, it prevents us from looking at the real power dynamic of the crime.
And that's for sure. And you know, when we're talking about rape culture, we're not just talking about rape itself. We're talking about the culture of society. And there was recently, when we talk about the justice system, I mean, we've got problems with the judges themselves. And to talk about that, I've got an interview with Karen Busby, who is a law professor at the University of Windsor, talking about a recent judge's decision. And I've got that clip for us now.
Sure. I'm Karen Busby, a professor of law at University of Manitoba.
So did you want to give me some background on the Rhodes decision?
Okay. Well, this case, the incidents that gave rise to this case occurred in 2006, and a young woman, a 20-year-old woman, went to the bar with a friend of hers. She was dressed in a way that thousands of women across the country dress on a Saturday night when they're going out to the bar. When she was at the bar, she met a man, and 20 minutes later, he sexually assaulted her. So they'd known each other for all of 20 minutes before the assault occurred. She repeatedly, when he expressed sexual interest in her, she initially gave him a kiss, but then she repeatedly said no, she had no interest in participating in sexual activity with him. She was in a car with him and some other people, and she said, leave me alone, and she was angry that he wouldn't leave her alone, so she got out of the car, and then he got out of the car a little while later and followed her. During the assault, she asked if she was going to be killed. That's how vicious the assault was. She actually feared for her life during the assault. She ended up with a bruised back and with a bloody knee. And she says that she's still afraid to leave her home 5 or 6 years after the assault occurred. Oh, and I should add, she's Aboriginal. She's an Aboriginal woman. And he was 35. So she's a small Aboriginal woman, and he, according to the transcript, is a large 35-year-old man.
Do you think that the Aboriginal issue played a part in this?
It's difficult to say without more facts on the specific case itself, you know, whether or not sexism was operating or racism was operating in the way in which the perpetrator was thinking or the way in which the judge was thinking. But the reality is, you know, we have 500 missing and murdered Aboriginal women right now across the country, and we know that racism, at least in the form of indifference, has, you know, contributed to, you know, the failure over years to do much about their plight. If you think of something like the Picton Farm case, you know, Aboriginal women had been reporting about this guy for years, and the police had done nothing about him. One woman had escaped from the farm, and the police had done nothing about him. So we are pretty sure racism was operating in that situation. We don't have direct evidence of that in this case, but I wasn't at all surprised when I learned that it was an Aboriginal woman who had been assaulted.
You'd mentioned the legal stuff. there's a consent issue here.
Well, it's important to remember in this case that the man was convicted. He argued that he had a mistaken belief that she was consenting, but the judge rejected that as an argument. And based on the fact that she repeatedly said no, and during the assault he asked if he was going to kill her, and then he continued to assault her, the judge really had to find that she wasn't consenting, and he knew she wasn't consenting by her very direct words and the fear that she expressed during the assault. So it's curious that consent comes up in kind of a backdoor way during the sentencing hearing. And basically what happened during the sentencing hearing is a judge needs to make a decision whether or not this is a major sexual assault, because if it is, then 3 years or more jail time are warranted. That's what the case law says. And so the question was this a major sexual assault? And it was in the context of making a determination as to whether or not this was a major sexual assault that the judge, said the kinds of things that he said about sex being in the air. This is a clumsy Don Juan, that this was inconsiderate behavior. The judge was trying to really come to the conclusion that this was not a major sexual assault in making that determination. Now, that's just plain weird. Again, this is a woman who feared for her life. She ended up with bruises on her back and a bloody knee, and she lives with the significant psychological impacts of the assault. It's hard to imagine how you can justify saying this is anything other than a major sexual assault. I should add that he penetrated her vaginally. He attempted to penetrate her anally, and he also performed oral sex on her. So it was multiple forms of assault. So it's hard to see how this is not a major sexual assault.
Since the sentencing report, there's been action against, correct?
The Canadian Judicial Council has reported that they've received a number of complaints from members of the public. They don't say how many complaints they've received or who they're by, but my understanding from media accounts is that the Canadian Federation of Students has filed a complaint, and the minister responsible for the status of women in Manitoba has also filed a complaint. I think there are a number of other individual complaints as well. So that's one action that's been taken. And generally, the Judicial Council makes its decisions within 2 months, and rarely does it take more than 6 months to make a decision. So we have to wait a little while for a decision for them, but it shouldn't be that long. The other action that's been taken is the Chief Justice of the Manitoba Court of Queen's Bench, which is the court that Judge Dewar sits on, has stated that Dewar will not hear any cases of a sexual nature until the Judicial Council decision comes down. And this week he was scheduled to hear a manslaughter case. I don't know anything more about it, whether or not it was manslaughter of a family member or what was going on in that case. And he was taken off the manslaughter case this week. As a lawyer, I wouldn't make a determination about what should happen to him without more facts. But certainly the public reaction has been very strong, and people are very unhappy that he's stayed on the bench. But we don't have all of the facts yet, really, so it's difficult to make a determination about what's an appropriate outcome in the case. One thing I think that's different in 2011 that we might not have seen 10 years ago or 20 years ago is when these comments were reported in the media, there's mass protest against them. And I'm actually surprised at the degree of public outrage in this case. I'm heartened by the degree of public outrage, but I'm surprised by it. So I do think that, nobody I have talked to at all has said that these comments were appropriate comments. Some people have said, I want more context, but nobody can think of any kind of justification for the comments that were made in this case. So to that extent, I think something significant has changed, because I would have expected that there would be something of a backlash against the comments, against the public reaction in this case, and that hasn't occurred. But having said that, we are faced with a situation where the myth that women will have sex with all comers is at play, that Aboriginal women want to have sex all the time is another myth that might be at play in this case, and if a man is aroused, then he's got to be satisfied by someone is another myth that has to be acknowledged as operating in this case. And I would have thought that those four myths were behind us. But this case demonstrates that at least for some, they're not behind us. They're not behind us for a man like Mr. Rhodes, the convicted person in this case, and they don't seem to be behind us for the judge in this case either.
We are all in this together, brothers and sisters. We can do better. Raise your voices.
And we're back. And I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Kimberly Godreau.
And we're on the phone with Margaret Lazareth. And I just want to warn the listeners to let you know once again that this show is about sexual abuse and sexual assault and rape culture. And if you are triggered by these concepts, maybe this is not the best time to listen to CHRW. And you might want to catch this on podcast a little later at www.betweenthemargins.ca when you can be in control of your own environment and not be triggered by the content of this show. Otherwise, please stick with us, and this is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. You there, Margaret?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. Sometimes I lose people, and I don't like hearing that. So we heard Karen Busby's stuff.
Yes, and I thought that was interesting because I, too, shared the notion with her that we had successfully we had dispelled the mythology, or at least so many years of activism had at least tempered it. And when it rears its head again, it's always such a disappointment. But we have to realize that it's, I mean, it's people saying it's there. I mean, it hasn't gone away. And perhaps what's happened is people realize they shouldn't say it, they shouldn't express it, but it's underneath. And I too am aware of a case where an 11-year-old girl was a judge said she asked for it and the perpetrator was 20. So I we just always have to keep vigilant, and it is exciting that there is, when it does happen, that there is an outcry, and the outcry has to get bigger and bigger. And what I think that will do, hopefully, is at least on the surface level, tell people that they can't say it publicly. And that's the first step in eliminating an attitude. It's not getting rid of it completely. But if people are not saying it in public, then it doesn't have the same force. It doesn't have the same, and perhaps another generation, and I mean, and sadly, but then the next generation will hear it less and less, and it may eventually dissipate. And we know how long it's taken other really bad attitudes to disappear, and many of them are not gone completely either. But it's a process, and at least it's ongoing, and it hasn't slipped back completely. And you know, when a judge makes a comment like that, there is a hue and cry, and there are negative repercussions for making that kind of a comment.
Does this mean it's time for another movie?
Sure.
Oh, rape culture. We haven't moved.
Yes, I know. No, I mean, we have moved. We really have. It's not, as your last guest pointed out, in another time there wouldn't have been repercussions for this judge, and now there are.
Have you noticed?
But it's a power struggle, and it's like trying to push down something squishy. It comes up in other places, we just have to keep at it and move the line. I thought, it's time for another movie when we did Rape Is, and I know it's time to do it again. I think another thing that's changed is that that legally there has been really some progress. The international and the International Tribunal in The Hague has determined that rape is a tool of war. It's a war crime, and that's a very big deal to get people who and look at war crimes and genocide to see rape as part of this and see it as part of a strategy to demoralize. To see it in that context is a very important step forward, which we have to be grateful for our step forward.
Those step forwards are very important. You keep mentioning Rape Is, and I actually have a promo of Rape Is here for the listeners so they can hear what that's all about.
Okay.
Do you know what rape feels like? Do you know what it feels like to have our howl silenced by a fist? What it feels like when you are rushed into, pressed down on, and opened by a knife? A blade so thick, so strong, so brilliant that your insides no longer exist. You're scraped against insides, bleeding to a loud yell that only you and others like you can hear. It happens in wars, in homes, in children's bedrooms, on dates, in marital bedrooms, in prisons, in brothels, on the street. When you are matted down and wanted to stop, want it to cease, but it keeps on trudging, moving at its own pace, rate, beat, without a brief glance at your dead face, hollowed eyes.
There wasn't a moment of the day that I didn't think about being raped, that it didn't affect my conversation, that it didn't affect where I went and what I did, what I wore.
Going, going, coming, coming, crying, crying, screaming, until it stops. No, until you think it stops, and then from nowhere, from no one, it keeps on. He continues to destroy your petals with his... You don't even want to say it. Look at how long it takes to recover from rape, and look at the consequences of one act of rape, because all the women I know who have been violated have spent most of their lives recovering or surviving from that one act. Name it, remember it, live with it, within it, own it, because it was never yours to own, but it is in front of you, behind you, on top of you, rammed in you. Damaging, eradicating, crushing, sterilizing, annihilating, beating, scarring, inscribing, defying, and killing.
Women say all the time that I just can't seem to wash myself clean enough. I mean, they'll take showers 5 times a day before work, you know, after work, before bed, get up in the middle of the night, and it's something that's inside their soul.
What it feels like to have a firecracker blow up inside of you to celebrate someone else's freedom. What it feels like to cry out, to be stamped out, and have everyone else look away.
Having gone to Bosnia or the former Yugoslavia during the war, I couldn't believe there was such a thing as a rape camp in the middle of Europe. Just to see how many women had suffered from ethnic cleansing and systematic raping was terrifying, and it really altered my whole vision of the world. It seems to be rape is the central, both act and metaphor, of violence against women.
Bosnia, Sierra Leone, Rwanda, hundreds of thousands of women systematically raped as a tool of war.
Therefore, find you guilty and Article 5 of the statute.
The international community is finally recognizing that rape is a crime of genocide, a crime against humanity, a crime that controls, dominates, degrades, and psychologically kills whenever it happens. But many people think of human rights violations as things that happen far away in other countries to other people, and they don't recognize the human rights violations that happen in their own countries.
So
there you go. Well, I just listened to this. I wanted to thank the incredible women who helped me and who were in that movie. And the movie begins with a poem by Salome Shatila, who's a poet, a scholar, professor, and she's just an extraordinary person. And then intertwined with her poem were you heard Diane Rosenfeld, who's a professor at Harvard Law School, who teaches about sexual, she's about a lot of things, but she specializes in issues of violence against women and is an activist trying to work to end it. And you also heard Eve Ensler in there, who talked about her international projects, where she's been so active. And at that point, she was in Bosnia and the Congo, and so active internationally preventing rape, and talked about herself as a survivor, an incest and rape survivor. And it was the voices of these women that and men that we connected in the movie, and tried to make people see how big the issue is and how encompassing it was, and how and also, as I said earlier, frame it as a human rights issue. So, and we created not just the website for Cambridge Documentary Films, but also we created a Rape is Resources website to go along with the film, with help from those folks. And it was an extremely important project for me. And it's getting out there. The movie's getting out there. One of the most exciting things is that people are showing it to, recruits, military recruits, and in the different armed forces. And getting wonderful responses, and it's not just, as we like to say, preaching to the choir. It's not just women's activists showing the film. It's people showing it to their own groups. It's people doing outreach and education at universities and community organizations, and in some cases even for new military recruits, which is fabulous. As a filmmaker, you couldn't dream anything better than that.
Yeah, well, those military recruits, there's an article last fall where a U.S. judge says lesbians can be cured by male soldiers by basically raping them and converting them to straight.
Such ghastly mythology, as we keep talking about, still persists. Think of the horror of that. And in fact, it really is, it's emblematic of the whole concept of rape. It's that somehow women want it, no matter who they are, whether they're 80 years old, whether they're lesbian, whether they're 3 years old, and because it's the will of the perpetrator, that's the most important thing. And it doesn't matter what any other choices that anybody else makes, including how to define their own sexuality. So you really just got to the heart of the rape myth in that. So,
yeah, and when we talk about people in authority that are perpetrating the myths, there is just an incident in Toronto where a police officer was talking to a women's studies class and talked about women dressing like sluts, bringing the experience on themselves, and you just don't expect all of this to come at us. And it seems like in the last 6 months we've just been bombarded by judges and police officers and people in authorities and our own prime minister that closed all of our women's issues offices, saying they're unneeded in this country. It seems like we're under attack again.
But on the plus side, there's a lot of people starting to stand up and take notice and fight, like the activists doing the slut walk in Toronto.
Yes, and we have a clip from Heather Jarvis, who is organizing that, in reaction to this Toronto police officer.
Hi, I'm Heather Jarvis. I am a queer, sex, body positive feminist. I have experience in gender and sexuality studies, social work, community activism, and I've been pissed off by this. So I'm a co-founder of Slutwalk Toronto, and this really did spring out of unofficial frustration. It was really just connecting with the other co-founder, Sonia Barnett, who you emailed initially, connecting with her through online media, through Facebook, Twitter, and we were both outraged upon hearing that this Toronto police officer encouraged women not to dress like sluts, so as not to be victimized. We were both outraged, and really it sprang out of that about
let's do something. Okay, where'd we start? So it really was very unplanned, very, you know, some people might say very organic, but it really, it, that's how it came about. And then the name sort of just to me one day about Footwalk. So it's taken a couple weeks since it's happened because we really want to have, we feel like we want to have a strong, respectful, but directed position on what we want and where we're coming from. So pretty much what we've come, where we're at now is this is, it's angry. We're frustrated at the Toronto Police as a protective service, that they're continuing to slut shame people and make people at risk of sexual assault or survivors of sexual assault feel blamed and feel deserving of this. These stereotypes and myths that are completely inaccurate. It's not about what you wear. It's not about how you look, because there are too many cases that completely blow that out of the water. So we're angry and demanding that an apology is not enough. An apology, a written apology, and, you know, the vague statement of, yes, the officer has reprimanded, it's not enough. It's a bigger issue. So we decided to unite with people, go to Toronto headquarters, their front door, and tell them what we think.
And they are going to tell them what they think on April the 3rd, 2011, starting at Queen's Park, and speeches start at 1:30, and you can go to slutwalktoronto.com for more information about that. So they're getting active anyways.
Yeah, and it's such a comment on power, that dressing attractively and alluringly is so pushed upon all of us. It's like, if you don't do it, there's something wrong with you. You're supposed to look a certain way. You're supposed to, I mean, every image you see, it is, you know, you see cleavage, you see part of people's, you know, low cut things, and that's considered beautiful, and in many cases it really is beautiful, and yet here it is pushed so hard, and we all, you know, want to be attractive and we all want to be appealing, and then the minute somebody violates your rights, that's why you're blamed. It's just such a vicious position. You want to be positive about yourself, you want to be attractive, you want to dress well, and you're not really given the opportunity. If you go against that, I mean, everyone says, oh, that person is a, you know, a slob or fuddy-duddy or doesn't take care or doesn't respect themselves. That's the other one, if they don't. And yet, there it is. It's just such a vicious trap.
Catch 22, eh?
I think that's so exciting that I think the slut walk is fabulous, and maybe if we can force people to reframe some of these antiquated notions, things will improve a little.
Well, one of the criticisms that slut walk is taking is on the strong language and the reclamation of the word slut.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, in my opinion, you know, it's causing people to have the conversations that they need to say.
Yes. And, boy, we need to have those conversations. And we need to understand, you know, that even, I mean, it's even some degree of conformity, you know, with cultural norms. And we're pressured to do it, and yet, the language changes so much. It's considered, oh, she's beautiful, and then the minute something negative happens, well, she was a slut. So I love the fact that we're forcing us to have conversations about the language.
Yeah, well, do you remember the Delta Kappa Epsilon's pledge ritual that hit the media last fall? Do you remember that one?
Yeah, vaguely. Why don't you describe it, and I'll add what my take was.
They had their new pledges, walking through campus, screaming, "No means yes, yes means anal."
Yes, yes, that's right.
And took major flack for it.
Yes, you know, and that's. it's a message. There it is underneath. And you know, there, what can I, you know, what is there else to say? But it's just the, it's taking on, the myths of the culture and, sending them into the stratosphere. Sometimes I wonder about these things, like when we call attention to these things, what kind of judgments we have to make about that. I remember so clearly being told years ago when we were protesting what we called a film that had some snuff implications, and a snuff film was a film where the myth was that that a woman was actually killed in the, where it shows a woman being killed in the movie in a sex crime, a sexual murder, that it was actually true. And I remember some distributor once saying, great, tickets sell tickets. And there's some part where we have to exercise, I think, a little, when we call attention to this pledge thing, that's really an important thing to do, because that's just a bunch of relatively uninformed and vicious college students doing something. But when we call attention to something that, where there's a where attention means an economic payoff for the perpetrators, we have to be a little careful.
Absolutely, and that's where we have to keep vigilant and keep mainstream media in check.
Right, and not just fall into the trap of reacting to everything, because sometimes we're being manipulated to react. And so we just have to keep dialoguing with each other, and doing shows like this, and thinking really hard about what's going to make real change and what's going to support the status quo, and that kind of critical attention to what we're doing needs to be paid as well.
Yeah, and I mean, the Toronto Rape Crisis Center has some suggestions on what we can do to transform rape culture, and they've got 20 of them on their website, but I'm not going to read them all. But some of them are, you know, some pretty basic and simple things. You know, speak up, don't listen quietly, teach your children to respect children of the opposite gender, talk to your boys about their sexuality and talk to them about their responsibility. Talk to girls about their sexuality. You know, support your daughters, nieces, and neighbors and encourage them to have strength. You know, these are all, you know, pretty basic, obvious things that we need to do, but we know these things, and yet, you know, it seems like we're taking three steps forward and one or two steps back.
Yes. Well, as I talk all the time, there's this horrible pushback. And also it's very hard for most people to get unified around it, because there's so many perks for not doing it. In terms of male power, there are tremendous perks. But even for women, keeping quiet, accepting the good parts of sexual attention and not the, fitting in and being attractive to men, without seeming like a pain or a nag or being. There's so many perks to keeping quiet, and we're so. You know, and as genders, we're so interwoven with each other. We have sons, we have partners, we have husbands. It's a hard thing. And one exciting thing, and one great development over the years in this struggle, and the number of men who are getting it and who are being who are supporting and being active, and that's a great development. And I know just presenting some of these issues on to the middle school and high school students, so many young men coming up, and even men who've been around for a while, are get it. They see it, and So that's a great part of
positive.
Our three steps forward, isn't it?
It is. So we're out of time, Margaret, but can you tell the audience how they can get your documentaries?
Well, you can go onto the internet, and we're at www.CambridgeDocumentaryFilms, and that's plural, and it's .org because it's a nonprofit organization, and that there's an online way of ordering it. And what you see there are institutional prices. That means public performance rights prices for sale to universities and libraries. So if it's out of your ken, check. A lot of public libraries and many universities in Canada own our material. So, and if you can't find it, just shoot us an email and we'll look up who has it nearby.
Wonderful.
So, and thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for doing this show, Michelle. It's really so important, and we have to just keep on at it, as you so aptly pointed out.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. And that's all we've got for you today, folks. My name's Michelle Boyce.
I'm Kimberly Gautreaux.
And this has been Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after on CHRW 94.9 FM.